From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On Twitter this morning, from Asia, President Trump nominated former pharmaceutical executive Alex Azar to replace Tom Price as Health and Human Services Secretary. Price had to step down after criticism that he misused taxpayer money on travel. And this morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Roy Moore, the retired Alabama judge running for the Senate, should step down from that race. McConnell saying he now believes the women who've made allegations of sexual misconduct against Moore. But a bit later, Moore tweeted out, "It's McConnell who should step down." And we await high-profile attorney Gloria Allred's news conference this afternoon with yet another woman who claims Moore sexually assaulted her when she was a minor. Domenico Montanaro is NPR lead politics editor. Domenico, let's see how this week is going to shake up. We have more Republicans distancing themselves from Moore, dropping the "if it's true" phrase. But Moore said he's going to sue the Washington Post, which first printed this story. His supporters seem to back him. How do you see this playing out?
Well, certainly this is a huge story. And Roy Moore, whether or not he decides to drop out, which doesn't look like he will, is going to be a big piece of whether or not Democrats wind up possibly winning that race in Alabama, which opens the door a crack for Democrats to try to take back the Senate in 2018. It's still an uphill climb and kind of a quadruple bank shot, and not an easy thing to do. But there is no path for that currently without a Democratic win somewhere other than the two states where they have some targets in Arizona and Nevada. So right now we've seen Mitch McConnell come forward, the Senate Majority Leader, and say that he thinks that Moore should step aside, that he believes the women here in this case. And President Trump, on the other hand, has still continued to say if these allegations are true, he should step aside. So we're starting to see a split among Republicans in whether or not they stick to the "if true" line or if they explicitly call for Moore to drop out.
Well, here's Mark Short, who's White House Legislative Affairs Director, seeming to echo what President Trump has said from Asia. And Short is speaking on NBC's Today Show.
There's no Senate seat more important than the notion of child pedophilia. I mean, that's the reality. But having said that, he has not been proven guilty of that, and we have to afford him the chance to defend himself.
I should say that was on Meet the Press. But do you think President Trump, who backed Moore's opponent in the primary, do you think he's going to have to step in here?
It depends on how far this winds up going. I mean, is there going to be more evidence? Is there going to be somebody else who comes forward? Is there something that winds up changing the trajectory for people like Mark Short and President Trump as he heads back from this trip from Asia? The last thing the president wants, as he's got this Russia probe sort of encircling the White House now, with more people on his staff being interviewed, is to be dragged down into another controversy. So, you know, you very well could see the president weigh in more strongly, but there's no indication of that at this point. No reason to think he would necessarily.
Talk about the nomination over the putting forth of Alex Azar's name to be Health and Human Services Secretary. He's a pharmaceutical executive, former. How's that going to go over?
Well, Azar is somebody who has some experience in the Health and Human Services Division in that agency, because he was the former deputy secretary under George W. Bush and under Tommy Thompson, who was the Republican Health and Human Services Secretary. He is a former pharmaceutical executive at Eli Lilly for the last 5 years, from 2012 to 2017. And so his nomination shouldn't be all that controversial, given that he's been in that agency previously. I mean, it's more experience, frankly, in that agency than Tom Price had, who is the outgoing secretary, who was a member of Congress and a doctor. There could be some controversy with Azar if Democrats want to stir up some old stuff from the 1990s, because Azar, even though he has quite the pedigree at Dartmouth College and Yale Law School, he did work in the special counsel's office independent counsel's office with Ken Starr, where he was investigating Whitewater and the Clintons. So you never know. That could come up in a confirmation hearing.
Right, right. Real quick on the Republican tax cut plans, the House votes on their bill on Thursday. This morning, the president tweeted that he hopes they put in a measure to repeal the Obamacare health insurance mandate. Then you got the Senate plan unveiled last week. It has that complete elimination of popular deductions for state and local taxes. Where do you see this going?
Well, right now, the the House is hoping to bring it to the floor toward the end of the week, seeing how the whip goes during the week to see where the votes are. As far as the mandate repeal, there's no interest right now in doing that, it seems, according to the Speaker's office, that they're turning this into a health care debate is not something that they really want to do right now. That's not where they're looking. They'd like to be able to keep coalescing around the idea of tax cuts.
Well, real quick, how do you think the president's done on his Asia trip? He seemed to back Russia President Putin over his own intelligence. He walked that back a bit, but he also, did not apparently talk at least deeply about human rights with President Duterte of the Philippines, seemed to pal around with him, somebody who's ordered the assassination of, over 6,000 people in his country. How's it gone?
There's this term normalizing that a lot of liberals use that they get annoyed with us in the media for saying that, we're normalizing President Trump. But I think the world is kind of getting hip to what his shtick is in a way. And they've sort of normalized how to deal with him. So while some of these things would be kind of big deals, the fact that, he's deciding to stand next to Duterte and not pushing him on human rights when all of these things are happening in his country. The president, that's sort of the way he is, and that's what world leaders have come to expect.
Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to Seattle, where a debate over immigrants has been playing out for months. A federal judge has blocked the Department of Justice from ordering immigration lawyers to stop helping immigrants who may be deported. The DOJ says the lawyers should not meet with the immigrants unless they're going to represent them in court. Again, that has been blocked. Liz Jones from member station KUOW reports.
In immigration court, there is no right to an attorney, and most people can't afford one. So if a volunteer lawyer offers some help, that's a big deal, especially if you're locked up. About 30 men file into a room at the Northwest Detention Center, a large immigration jail in Tacoma, Washington. The men all wear blue or green uniforms, and they all face deportation.
And do I have any more coming, or should I just go ahead and start?
Virginia Cole is here to give a legal workshop. She's with a nonprofit known as NERP, that's short for the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. It's one of the largest providers of free legal help for immigrants in the country. Cole surveys the room. Who has a court hearing this week, she asks. A few hands go up. And who has a private attorney? Just a couple. Cole's got a routine. She's led these workshops for 11 years, every week. One guy starts to ask about his personal case, but Cole sticks to her script about bonds, court schedules, and how deportation works. Then, time is up.
That goes by fast, huh?
It does, yes.
50 minutes, is that what you get?
Yes, yeah.
This free workshop is part of a legal program the federal government pays for at detention centers around the country. But what happens next has led to that cease and desist order. After the workshop, detainees line up to schedule one-on-one meetings with a volunteer attorney. Cole explains more as we leave.
So the last question I ask is if they don't have an attorney and they have additional follow-up questions and they want to speak with us individually, they can sign up.
She warns them the wait list is about a month long and help is limited.
We would love to be able to represent everybody who doesn't have an attorney. The reality is we just don't have the resources to do so.
That can mean just a few hours of help for a case that can take years to resolve, or maybe some help filling out asylum applications or some other court papers. And now, even this limited assistance is in jeopardy.
We are here in the matter of Northwest Immigrant Rights Project et al. Versus Sessions et al.
The Justice Department says immigration lawyers must sign on for the full case. It's all or nothing. No more a la carte help. One question raised in court is why this change is coming now.
I just want to be absolutely clear. There is just nothing to the claim that this is some change in regulation inspired by the administration.
This is the government's attorney, Fred Sheffield, at a hearing in Seattle Federal Court. The Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, NERP, has provided this kind of short-term, limited assistance for years, for thousands of people. So the group is suing the feds for the right to keep offering this limited help and to let similar nonprofits do so as well. The Department of Justice says it's only enforcing a 2008 rule intended to make sure lawyers do a fair job. It requires lawyers to formally go on record as someone's attorney if their help goes beyond general advice.
If you're going to talk to the immigration court in context of making legal arguments, we need to know who you are. And we need to know that you're going to be accountable. And we need to know that you've committed to the immigration court's rules. It encourages transparency.
One issue raised in the lawsuit is what triggers this rule to kick in. In other words, how much can a lawyer help before they cross the line? Judge Richard Jones is hearing this case in Seattle. He's also pressed DOJ for more clarity about this rule.
How are lawyers supposed to know in the interpretation if they've crossed the line? It causes grave confusion, doesn't it, for practitioners to know what are the lawyers supposed to do?
For now, Judge Jones has blocked the cease and desist order to the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. While it was in effect, the group turned away about 50 people, and that was just in 1 week. DOJ has said their intent is not to curtail legal help, but merely to ensure immigration lawyers follow the court's rules. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones in Seattle.
Fewer African elephants were poached in 2016. That's according to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. But the convention also estimates that the African elephant population has declined by 111,000 in the past 10 years. Some African conservation officers have been training to improve their skills at finding poachers at a sort of mausoleum for poached animals in Colorado. Sam Brash from Colorado Public Radio reports.
And I think we should probably get started on the tour here.
When the U.S. government seizes illegal wildlife products, they often end up here, at the National Wildlife Property Repository in Commerce City, Colorado. Colleen Schaefer is a specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is a business card holder out of a toenail of an elephant.
The object is one of 1.3 million at the repository. Schaefer leads the delegation of 42 officials through the warehouse. There's skin lotion made with caviar and pencil holders made from baby rhino feet. Georgina Kamanga is the lead intelligence officer for the Zambian Department of National Parks and Wildlife. She looks through a box of elephant skin wallets and accessories.
It makes me feel bad because the products are just too much.
Kamanga recently gained a bit of international fame. She appears in The Ivory Game, a Netflix documentary that centers on an international ivory smuggler. In the film, Kamanga leads a raid against one of his syndicates.
This is full-length ivory.
Fresh.
Very fresh.
A Tanzanian court sentenced the smuggler to 12 years for his poaching crimes. Kamanga says that conviction had a lot to do with the careful police work that followed the raid.
Evidence was secured. It was properly labeled. Everything went according to plan.
Holding on to evidence can be a challenge, according to Dave Hubbard. He oversees U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents who work abroad, and he says the value of contraband can be a temptation for low-paid wildlife officers.
The seized wildlife, through corruption or other means, can go out the back door and be sold again, and there's no accountability for it.
That's why U.S. officers ran this training at the Colorado Repository. It serves as a classroom for how to keep evidence secure and carefully cataloged. Mike McLeod is an IT specialist with the Fish and Wildlife Service. He walks the delegation through how the U.S. tracks evidence of wildlife crimes.
So I have this lovely handbag.
It's a tiger print bag made from stingray skin. He assigns it a barcode, takes a photo, and enters the information into a laptop.
The best evidence handling, even the best lab analysis, if it's not documented properly, consistently, easily retrievable, it's worthless.
The process sounds high-tech, but McLeod says it doesn't need to be. A notebook can be a database. He also recommends regular checks to make sure no evidence has gone missing. Kamanga, the Zambian wildlife officer, says she'll take that tip to heart.
I have to ensure when I go back home, I share this with other colleagues that I work with.
Kamanga says she's glad that the U.S. is taking such an active role to fight wildlife trafficking in Africa.
What has been detected is more like a tip of an iceberg. There is more, and we really need to collaborate further and work so hard to ensure that these poachers are nailed before they cross borders.
Nailing poachers is Ed Newcomer's job. He's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Attaché for Southern Africa. He says the repository is a teaching lab, but it should also be seen for what it is.
Which is a collection of some of the most iconic species in the world
that are no longer living. You will not have an opportunity to see those elephants or those tigers or those lions in the wild again, because now they're in a warehouse in Colorado.
A warehouse that's at once proof of the size of the problem and proof of the international commitment to fighting it. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash.
Well, it's been a very busy couple of months for news, multiple hurricanes, shootings, and of course, politics. But not all news coverage is created equal. A team of researchers at MIT has developed a platform that reveals how news events are framed by hundreds of media outlets around the world. Anushka Shah is a researcher on that project called the MIT Media Cloud. She joins us now. Anushka, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And before we try this out, tell us what the Media Cloud does.
Sure. So the Media Cloud is essentially a news analysis platform. It's entirely open source, so anyone can use it. It was built by a group of researchers between the MIT Media Lab and the Harvard Berkman Klein Center. The platform allows you to ask important questions about, you know, the method behind the media's madness. So things about attention, influence, framing. For example, if you wanted to know how much attention is which outlet paying to Kenya's elections or foreign affairs in general, how is immigration framed in the US versus the UK? So questions like that, but not just for the US media. We have about 25,000 different sources from over 120 countries and over 20
languages.
And
you're just looking at all of these sources and seeing how they play different stories.
That's right. We're looking at how they play different stories and the language they use to talk about those events, which, you know, the framing that's used essentially plays a big role in how we understand the news.
Okay, well, let's try this out here. And let's look at the coverage of three recent news events, the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the attack in New York, and the mass shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Show me how it works and what you found.
Absolutely. So what you could do on the platform is you could put in search terms for each of those three events, and then you would hit the run button and you'd basically get a set of results that looked at the stories and the language and so forth. What we see for the Las Vegas and Texas shooting is that murders and attempted murders is the top theme identified, while for the New York attack, we have terrorism as a key theme.
Hmm.
So what that kind of points to is that for, you know, the Vegas and the Texas shooting, we tend to put it into this frame of isolated events that happen because of fringe elements of society, while something like terrorism is linked with these causal factors like religion and Islam and, you know, immigration.
And that's just the words that are being used in the stories about these events.
That's right. So, for example, for the New York attack, if you look at the most frequently used words, you'd see terror, terrorist, immigration. But if you looked at the other two, you see things like victims, shooter, weapons.
Hmm. I know that there was also some interesting analysis of how the three hurricanes that happened one after the other, Harvey, Irma, and Maria, were covered. Harvey in Texas, Irma was the one that hit Florida, and Maria was the one that hit Puerto Rico. And a lot of people said that Puerto Rico has been forgotten by the politicians and the media.
Right. So when we looked at the attention that the U.S. media gave these three, we saw that Harvey got about three times more coverage than Puerto Rico and Maria. And what's interesting is not just in the U.S., but when we looked at a collection of global English news sources, which was over 1,500 news outlets, we saw the same bias. What's even more interesting is if we throw in the South Asia disasters that happened, the floods, the Indian media itself also covered Harvey more than it covered any of the disasters in its own region.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. And you also looked at the coverage of the Me Too campaign. People were sharing their stories of being sexually harassed after the Harvey Weinstein allegations. What did you find there?
Yeah, that was interesting. We found a trend that we actually see frequently in gender reporting, that the frame of reporting is very much focused on law and order and far less on social issues. So, for example, when they were covering Harvey Weinstein, he was let off pretty easy. You know, there were no harsh words like sex predator or any of that. The most negative word used for him on an average was disgraced.
Hmm. And what does that tell you?
So it kind of tells you that there's a different treatment of the offender depending on who they are, their race, where they come from. A lot of the stories that we also saw were putting it, you know, we're talking about different incidences and crimes that happen against women. Not so much about practices like gender inequality and patriarchy and preference of, you know, sons over daughters, for example, in places like Asia. So there was no connection to that or the deep normative behavior that determines why something like sexual assault is so frequent.
And MIT's Media Cloud is open to the public, right? Anybody can use it.
Absolutely. Anyone can use it. All you need to do is have an email account and just register on the website.
And what's the point of that? What do you want people to be able to do with this?
The point is very much to allow people to have a stronger tool to be able to analyze and reflect on the media, to try and make it a more civic and democratic tool, to allow people to hold the media accountable for different things, to let nonprofits kind of design better media campaigns, activists to understand how they can put their agenda into the media. So the idea is to make it a healthy democratic tool.
It's interesting what you found about the hurricanes because, you know, we do a 2-hour program every single day and have been covering all of these news stories. And I don't think that there was a difference in how much we covered Maria and how much we covered Harvey or how much we covered Irma. But perhaps when you actually look at the data, there is.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a purpose it serves as well. I think the election has made it a hot topic for the media to comment on the media. And it's nice when, as a journalist, you can look at the collective buzz put together, not just by your station, but also, you know, the entire media fraternity overall. And what is that single loudest message that's going out to the public? So if the data is able to show that, hey, Puerto Rico is getting ignored, maybe there's the need to overcompensate even for that.
What's the next step for the Media Cloud? Is there something that you would like it to be able to do that it can't do yet?
You know, a big point of creating open source tools is to allow the users to define how it's best used. We'd like it to be as flexible to be used by journalists, activists, nonprofits, foundations. So I think we just want it to be a frequently used tool.
That is Anushka Shah, who's a researcher at the MIT Center for Civic Media. And we will link you to the Media Cloud at our website, hereandnow.org. Anushka, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
One of America's most reliable companies said today that it's slashing its dividend by 50% and restructuring its business model. GE is cutting the quarterly payment it makes to investors for just the third time since 1899 and hoping to streamline this once formidable conglomerate into a handful of key businesses. Mike Regan, a senior editor with Bloomberg News, has taken a look. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Robin.
So GE has been struggling. A new CEO came on board this year to try to lead a turnaround. But the company's dividend has long been one of the best in the country. Was that the problem? They were paying out too much. They need that cash to fix problems?
Well, yeah, it became clear that they just simply were not going to generate enough cash flow to comfortably pay that dividend. Part of today's news, in addition to the cut in the dividend, was they drastically lowered their earnings forecast to as little as $1 a share per year. And so if you figure you're paying 24 cents a share every quarter, that means almost all your, you know, dividends, almost as much profit as you're making. So it's, you know, it was a tenuous situation for them to keep paying this healthy dividend.
Right. Well, Wall Street seemed to approve. But what happened here? You know, they're going to save about $4 billion a year by cutting the dividend. What are the problems they need to fix?
Well, it's one of these things that when you have a new CEO come in like John Flannery, it's a lot easier for a new CEO to take these big sort of painful steps to turn around a company. And what they're doing is obviously selling off a lot of assets. They're going to be laying off people. And all those things save the company money in the long run. But in the short run, it can be very expensive to do. So it's all sort of part of the same turnaround plan that they have under the new CEO.
Right. Well, by the way, might some investors flee? You know, retirees rely on this kind of dividend income. Will they lose investors?
Yeah. And well, the stock is it's down a little bit today. It's down over 40% over the last 16 months. So it's clear that a lot of investors have bailed out on this stock. For a retiree, someone like that who has a lot of a single stock in their portfolio, it's a good reminder to always diversify and not have too much of your savings in one stock.
Well, how about a reminder to a big conglomerate? You said they're selling off assets. They want to concentrate on just aviation, power, and healthcare. What does this say about the state of conglomerates?
Well, I think it's always wise for a company to diversify. And in the 80s and maybe early 90s, Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, was considered a big role model for how much he diversified this company. But they've sort of taken it to the extreme, and not just today's actions, but remember they sold NBC Universal. They got out of a lot of the financial services business they were in. The company became so sprawling that it was very tough for Wall Street to get it, wrap its head around exactly everything that was in its business. Their financial statements became very complicated. And when you think about a Wall Street analyst trying to analyze a stock, well, if a company's in television and financial services and it's making jet engines and it's in healthcare, it becomes very hard to sort of wrap your head around a company that big. And I think they're proving that getting that big is not necessarily a good idea.
So now GE is aviation, power, and healthcare. At least that's what they want you to know going forward. Mike Regan, senior editor with Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
President Trump leaves the Philippines tomorrow after meeting with world leaders at the ASEAN summit over the weekend. Today, Trump met with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte and did not publicly criticize him for his war on drugs. Human rights groups have accused Duterte of sanctioning thousands of extrajudicial killings. For a deeper look at the Philippines, we're joined now by Sheila Coronel, a professor at the Columbia Journalism School. Professor Coronel, you've reported in the Philippines for decades. How big a departure is Duterte for the country's leadership?
Well, Duterte represents both something old and something new for the Philippines. He comes from a political family. His father was governor of Davao in Mindanao, but he is also the first president to come from Mindanao. So that's new.
Why is that significant?
That's significant because Mindanao is sort of the periphery. People from Mindanao have always complained about what they call Manila colonialism. They feel Manila is an imperial power, just as I suppose any other far-flung province of a country would feel that they do not have the attention. They don't get a fair share of the nation's resources or the attention of the national government. They also feel marginalized and they don't have a voice. And so his strongest constituency up to now is really the constituency of the periphery, people who feel have genuine grievances against the Manila elite and who feel they've been excluded and don't have a voice in the way the country is run.
Now, he has become famous around the world in part because of his brutal war on drugs in the Philippines. Give us a sense, first of all, because I know you've done reporting on this, of how that war has affected daily life in the Philippines.
The war is really largely limited to Metro Manila and some of the big cities in the country. If you are a poor Filipino living in the slum of Manila, you know, Manila has a population of about 11 million people. It's a large, sprawling city. Then you feel really nervous. You feel insecure. You feel that you may be targeted whether or not you are a drug user. You feel uncertainty. You feel like you're the target of the police. But if you live in a middle-class neighborhood or if you live outside of the big cities where drug dealing is rampant, then you're completely inured from it. You don't hear about it unless you watch television news or read the newspapers. So the drug war has claimed several thousand lives. The police say 3,500 people have been killed in what they call legitimate police operations, and that thousands more have been killed by so-called vigilantes, or these are killings by masked men in the dead of night. The police claim they have no knowledge of it, but certainly the body toll, the body count, however you look at it, it's several thousand, maybe up to 12,000 if you believe human rights groups, in the past 15 months. Hmm. That's a lot of dead bodies. The police say there have been no extrajudicial killings in the Philippines. They say these people who've been killed by the police at night have mainly fought back. But the reality is that very few policemen have been killed. There's very few policemen who've been wounded. And so it's a very one-sided fight. It's really a war against the poorest and most vulnerable sectors of the population.
In a televised address last month, Duterte ordered the Philippine police to end the war on drugs, but he also said that he hoped the decision would satisfy the bleeding hearts. Have things changed at all since that announcement was made?
There have been fewer police operations, but I know that there have been a number of people killed despite, you know, the day after or the week after that announcement. The pace of the killings has stopped, but it has not ended completely. The killings have not stopped completely.
The drug war is an important issue, but it's just one issue in the Philippines right now. What is the Philippines' relationship like with China?
Well, the Philippine relations with China have generally been, you know, since we opened diplomatic relations in the 70s, the Philippines has had, you know, fairly good relations with China, opening up trade and investments to the Chinese. The South China Sea continues to be an irritant in that relationship. President Aquino, who was president before Duterte was elected, took a hard line against the Chinese. He was sort of an exception in that sense, because he really brought it to confrontation and got a tribunal in The Hague to rule on whether Chinese claims on the islands in the South China Sea were legitimate. The tribunal ruled in favor of the Philippines. Duterte has taken a more conciliatory stance and put that ruling on hold. He's also held a China's request. He's also stopped construction on one of the reefs where the Philippines has had a long presence. And so Duterte has pulled back from Aquino. The difference with Duterte is he's taken, let's say, a much more overtly friendly stance towards China and a much more overtly anti-American stance.
And what about Russia? What's his relationship like with Vladimir Putin?
You know, he has a bromance with both Trump and Putin. So he's very friendly towards Putin as well. But, you know, he's also called Xi Jinping, you know, like a brother. So he's in this very, how do you say it, good company of bros in the who have a hand in the region.
And you say he has a bromance with Trump?
He definitely does. I mean, he said there's warm rapport between him and Trump. Trump congratulated him. There was a leaked transcript of a telephone conversation that President Trump had with Duterte, where Trump congratulated him for the incredible progress that Duterte has made in the drug war in the Philippines.
What about the U.S. relationship with the Philippines? As we know, the country was once an American colony. Is that still talked about today? And how much does that still weigh on the Philippines today?
You know, the Philippines has a long history with the United States. I would say it's a love-hate relationship. The Filipinos still remember the Philippine-American War, although not that much. But Filipinos also have very strong ties to the U.S. There are about 4 million Filipinos here in America,
right,
and American movies and American culture. We speak American English. So there are very strong both political ties as well as affective ties and family ties. Duterte has, you know, brought back that element of, you know, dug up, for example, American massacres during the Philippine-American War. He's also castigated the Americans for the hypocrisy towards human rights, all of them very, very legitimate. But, you know, Duterte has also accepted U.S. military assistance for fighting the war in Mindanao. So he's trying to have the best of both worlds. He both criticizes the U.S., but accepts and welcomes U.S. assistance in fighting ISIS in or ISIS-aligned terrorists in Mindanao.
You mentioned the war in Mindanao. Give us a little more details about that. What's going on there?
So there's a Muslim minority in the Philippines. They have been, since the 1970s, been in some sort of war with the Philippine government. In the 1970s, it was really a war for autonomy and independence. It's never been settled. The Muslims in the Philippines, the Mora people, as we call them, have genuine grievances against the Philippine government. It's a battle over land. It's a battle over identity. It's a battle of recognition of the distinctiveness over their history and their culture. there have been several attempts to have peace negotiations with various Moro movements, Moro separatist and nationalist movements. Unfortunately, many of those peace negotiations have failed. So now you have a younger generation of dissatisfied Moros who've seen the failures of those movements and have opted for a more radical approach. I think to say that they are ISIS involved or linked to ISIS is a little bit of an overreach. I think they're inspired by ISIS. They see ISIS as articulating their own resentments against their own government and the global world order. But it's largely a homegrown rebellion with deep regional and also ethnic roots. So what we saw, for example, in Marawi, the takeover of Marawi, the most Islamic city in Mindanao in the Philippines, stems from regional resentments and historical injustice, but taking on some of the ISIS rhetoric.
That's Sheila Coronel, who is co-founder of the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism and a professor at the Columbia Journalism School. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Natural history collections are really time capsules. They preserve evidence of life on Earth. And these collections, birds or bones, stones, butterflies, carry the fingerprints of those who collected them. Their passions, their interests, their hard work are part of what's being stored in display cases or dusty drawers. So when a collection's future is threatened, it gets personal. Irina Jurov from WHYY's The Pulse reports on an effort to save one man's cherished work.
In 1962, Neil Douglas accepted a position in the brand new biology department of what is now the University of Louisiana, Monroe. Because the department was new, there were no specimens to work with.
So I began collecting frantically all the fishes and frogs and toads and snakes and lizards and mammals that I could get hold of.
He arrived on campus with a U-Haul full of preserved animals. As he settled into his position, the collection effort focused on fish and turned more systematic.
I had an army of students that pursued their interest and my interest in far as collection of fishes, and we would take collecting trips.
ULM's fish collection grew to be one of the most scientifically important in the region. Scientists have described new fish species from this collection and have used it to evaluate changes in the environment. But Douglas retired, and the collection has spent the past 5 years cramped into an old locker room. It hasn't had a paid curator in years. And then, ULM received some money to renovate the athletic facilities and in early 2017 decided to get rid of the fish. Actually, it decided to get rid of two collections, the fish and the school's massive herbarium, its plant collection.
Competition and making money are foremost in administration of universities' minds. It's got to be.
Thomas Sasek is a biologist at the university and volunteers as a curator for both collections. In their last days at ULM, he navigates through the labyrinth of metal cabinets that house the herbarium to a case marked M. Sasek takes out some folders full of dried magnolia blooms mounted on paper.
This is a favorite one that a lot of people like. It's this grandiflora. It has really big leaves and beautiful flowers.
Magnolia is Louisiana's state flower.
This is from our local parish. So this says backyard of 205 Filial Avenue. I think that's Dr. Thomas's house.
We had just passed a portrait of Dale Thomas, who collected much of the herbarium. His picture was unceremoniously tucked behind some boxes.
There's a lot of stuff from his house.
Sasek wanted the collections to stay close so local students and researchers could use them. He arranged for the fish to go to Tulane University in New Orleans and the herbarium to go to Texas. Both are about 5 hours away. At least, Sasek concedes, they'll be well cared for and available to scientists.
It's just sad to see it go.
They're your experiences captured by plants on paper.
That's Barbara Tears, director of the herbarium at the New York Botanical Garden. She says there's a common narrative to these closings.
Generally, when a key player, a scientist who was really interested in the herbarium and devoted his career to building it, when that person leaves, sometimes they're not replaced with someone with similar research interests, and the herbarium is sent somewhere else.
The fate of a collection often depends on just one key person. But it's also something else, real estate.
It's always a function of the space that the collection occupies.
Hank Bart is the curator of the fish collection at Tulane University, the new home of ULM's fish collection. Tulane's fish are stored at a spacious former U.S. Navy facility, a half hour from campus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is kind of a wow thing.
Fish in jars occupy rows and rows of tall metal shelving. These glass jars full of fish strike me as retro. Like, somehow we've moved beyond this in science, and there isn't a need to preserve these almost Victorian artifacts. And Bart says that's sort of true.
One of the big things that's jeopardizing retaining collection curators, particularly in university campuses, is the change in biology.
Increasingly, biology is focused on studying cells rather than the whole organism. But Bart says you still need the full animal to get DNA, identify species, and understand what you're looking at. He says new hires are often molecular biologists who may disagree with him.
The interest in the collection just really plummets at that point because they've just a whole shift, you know, change in focus.
Are you concerned when you retire that that might happen?
Yeah, I am. I'm concerned about that. I am.
So Hank Bart is taking steps to make sure the collection is preserved once he's gone and keeping his fingers crossed that it works. For Here and Now, I'm Irina Zhurov.
And Irina's story comes to us from WHYY's health and science show, The Pulse. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.